Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, tomorrow is the deadline to register to vote in New York's primary. The producers of The Brian Lehrer Show and I are encouraging you to participate. We've been texting reminders to several hundred of you who signed up last week, and really this is it. The form needs to be in the mail by tomorrow, so if you aren't already registered, do it now if you want to vote in the April 19th New York presidential primary. And tomorrow on The Brian Lehrer Show, I'll talk with the journalists who were portrayed in the movie Spotlight. That's tomorrow, The Brian Lehrer Show, starting at 10 as every Monday through Friday morning here on WNYC. Rather than playing Name That Tune, which is easy, that's Bach's Violin Sonata Number 2. You knew that, right? Rather than playing Name That Tune, here's a challenge. Is the person playing in this piece a man or a woman? Can't tell, right? Back in the 1970s, only 5% of the musicians playing in the top five American orchestras were women. So the Boston Symphony Orchestra started holding blind auditions, meaning musicians sat behind a curtain so the selection committees could only hear them play. Now women comprise about 35% of those major American orchestras. By the way, the violinist that we are hearing is Hilary Hahn. So the curtain idea worked. Here to tell us about many other ideas for increasing gender and racial equality in the workplace by design is Iris Bonnet, a behavioral economist at Harvard and the author of What Works, Gender Equality by Design. Welcome to WNYC. Professor, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
So the Blind Symphony Orchestra auditions are a great example of better design to avoid employer bias. Are there things like that that can apply to a less simple measure than auditioning on a violin?
Absolutely. In fact, an increasing number of organizations are now blinding themselves to the demographic characteristics of job applicants for exactly the reason the orchestras at the time introduced curtains, namely to be able to benefit from 100% of the talent pool.
Give me an example, another example, in a more ordinary workplace than a symphony orchestra.
Yeah. So a number of organizations are now concerned that they, and these are private sector organizations, techs, I've just come back from the West Coast, tech sector organizations, which are concerned that they might care about the demographic characteristics of the people they are interviewing, and therefore, in particular, in early rounds, they blind themselves to their demographic characteristics. And some companies, in fact, the cloud storage company I just came across, does away with resumes altogether and bases their evaluations completely on work sample tests.
Another example of designing for equality might be the SAT, which changed the rules in 2012 so that guessing is no longer penalized. Did that level the playing field for SAT takers in this kind of way?
Absolutely. What the redesigned SAT, I mean, there are many, many design elements, but the one that you're alluding to here is trying to do is to level the playing field between risk takers and risk avoiders. It also turns out that there is typically a gender difference in willingness to take risk between men and women, with men being more willing to take risk than women. The old SAT, as some of our listeners might recall, had a multiple choice part, as does the new SAT, and people could choose between five potential answers to the question. They would get 1 point for every right answer and a quarter point deduction for every wrong answer. And that meant that early on, in fact, when you could exclude one alternative, it was rational or in someone's best interest to guess. Now, if people are different in their willingness to take risk, we'll have the risk-loving people guess earlier than the risk-avoiding people. And that, in fact, turned out to be a handicap for women, where a former student of mine, Katie Baldiga-Kaufman, studied this in the laboratory and had people come in, do the SAT, the regular SAT, multiple choice part, and then in a second round forced everyone to answer all questions. And with that, she could control for what people would have known had they answered all questions. So controlling for ability, it cost women dearly to not be willing to guess, but instead skip the questions on the SAT. So the new SAT does away with penalties, quite literally to level the playing field independent of people's appetite for risk.
That is so interesting. Listeners, any examples of design to make your workplace more equal that you could think of, or ones that you would like to see added to a workplace that you're in or wherever in? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. After the fascinating examples that we've heard already from Iris Bonnet, a behavioral economist at Harvard and author of the new book, What Works? Gender Equality by Design. At one point, you write, female employees at Google were twice as likely to quit their jobs. Why was that, and how did Google use data to rectify the problem, as you tell the story in the book?
We should address every problem by first understanding where it comes from. That's, not rocket science, obviously a very basic insight. But it turns out that too often we just throw money at problems, and including in the space that we're now concerned with, which is diversity and equality. And so what Google did instead, it was trying to unpack, why were these women leaving? And what it found was that it was not women in general who were more likely to leave, but young mothers. And for them, what they did to rectify that was to increase both maternity leave and parental leave. And women now, including young mothers, are no longer more likely to leave than their male counterparts or women without children.
Let's take a call. Jim in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm in my office today participating in with the committee interviewing people for an academic position within the CUNY system. One of the things we find in these kinds of searches that if you only go by blind credentials, for instance, you wind up reinforcing bias because you look at people's resume only and you get the same kinds of people from the same top universities. I'm sure your professor from Harvard knows all about this. And that you wind up overlooking people from different kinds of colleges, different kinds of backgrounds, different kinds of academic experience. So the model that your professor is suggesting sounds like it could work really well under certain circumstances, but it could also, under other circumstances, seem to reinforce a certain elitism and a certain bias. And I wonder if your professor can, as someone in academia who knows how these kinds of things work, mm-hmm. if she could address that.
Professor Bonnet, great question.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that question, Jim. So blind evaluations do not remove all our biases, in particular if we only remove somebody's names. But there are, of course, and there's lots of evidence and research suggesting that when you, for example, or your company would have gotten an application with the name, for example, being Jamal instead of John, John would have gotten many more callbacks than Jamal. So that's one sort of bias that we can do away with if we blind ourselves to people's names. However, as I said earlier, there are certainly companies like the cloud storage company Compose Inc., which I mentioned earlier, which do away with resumes altogether in order for them to truly focus on the person's performance and future potential. What they use instead is a work samples test. And in fact, much evidence suggests, and again, not a big surprise, work samples tests which mimic what your job will look like in the future are the best predictor of future performance, better than resumes, better than names, better certainly than interviews.
There are some fields, I'm thinking of my own field of journalism, where you so want diversity by design just for the quality of the work, right? Like if you're going to have a newsroom that covers a diverse area like New York City, well, that's just doing its job well, you want various kinds of diversity in the newsroom. And the blind applications may or may not reveal that to the news director, say, right?
So, for any organization, I would argue, you should decide consciously what you want to base your decisions on. And so you're saying we consciously, as public radio, for example, want to have a diverse set of reporters and journalists, and that's really important to us. And so I think that is a valid consideration as long as you make it consciously. The argument in my book is that much bias is unconscious. And we actually consciously, if I asked people, many people would say, well, no, we don't take demographic characteristics into account. All we base our judgments on is the performance that person has shown in the future in our prediction of future performance. Mm-hmm. And that's where blindness is really, really helpful. And that's, I think, where the orchestra example speaks for itself.
One piece of research you bring up in the book is that attractive people are expected to be better at solving mazes. What's that all about?
Yeah. So sadly enough, there are many biases which creep in when we see other people. And certainly there's much research suggesting that there's something that is called the beauty premium or the attractiveness bias. And that means that we associate attractive people with many of the attributes that we care about, including performance, but also, for example, trustworthiness. Now, it turns out that beautiful people are neither better performers nor more trustworthy. And then in one experiment, which I think is quite telling, when people found out that the attractive people were just average in terms of their trustworthiness, they were so disappointed that they then penalized them for the rest of the study.
Your subtitle is Gender Equality by Design. One way to design equality is through quotas. Do you have an example of where that's been successful? Because, as you know, quotas are somewhere between controversial and unconstitutional in this country.
Absolutely. And when I talk about design in the book, I'm trying to be quite clear that I talk about behavioral design, which builds on insights into our minds work and, in fact, wants to help us make better decisions. Quotas per se are not a behavioral design element, although they certainly affect our decision making. And there are a number of studies and examples where people have evaluated the impact of quotas. The best evidence, in fact, comes from a country that most people wouldn't think of immediately when they hear quotas, and that is India. In 1993, India amended its constitution to reserve a third of village heads for women. And what was interesting from a research point of view was that the third literally was picked out of a hat, so literally drawn randomly. And so researchers could follow this experiment for more than 20 years now and really measure what difference makes. And they do find, that's one of the most recent studies, I mean, lots of evidence on other things as well, but they do find that seeing is believing, and that one of the advantages of quotas, obviously, is that they change the numbers very, very quickly. And because we tend to care about what we see, or our minds tend to care about what we see, after having been exposed to at least two female village heads in those about more than 20 years now, villagers started to associate political leadership with women. And one of the core career aspirations, that's the most recent study published in Science, one of the core career aspirations of parents now is for their daughters to become politicians.
That's so interesting. So if one-third of village council seats have to go to women as a matter of quota under a constitutional amendment in India, I wonder if it flips the meritocracy / hiring kind of chicken and the egg problem, you know, on its head. People don't train for something because they don't see opportunity for themselves in that kind of a field. And so then you get people in a hiring position who, based on their view of merit, don't see qualified people from that population group applying for the jobs. And so they say, how can we have equality if there aren't an equal number of qualified applicants? And I wonder if by having the quota system, that then drives demand for training so that there are more people who then can be judged on meritocratic terms and it'll come out more even.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting way to put it, Brian. Not one that I actually thought of it myself, but it is an interesting way to break this vicious cycle that you just described, in that people do respond to the opportunities they see available to themselves. And in fact, again, building on how our minds work, it actually turns out that these don't have to be, you know, millions of new jobs, but just seeing counter-stereotypical examples, you know, such as male elementary school teachers, will affect men's mindsets and make them more open to considering that opportunity or possibility as a career path.
Radiant in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi. I'm calling because I work for a large bank, and I noticed that even though there's a big effort to hire diverse candidates, when we actually get to the job, we don't see a reflection of ourselves in upper management, and it's very discouraging. So I would like to see more support within the companies that are pushing for diversity once we're actually on the job.
Do you have any examples in the book, Professor, that relate to exactly this, either the banking industry or particularly the upper echelons?
Absolutely, on both of those. And I thank you for your question, Raiden. I think it actually is a particularly relevant question that we typically do see this pyramid where we have a large fraction of women entering a company, including the financial sector, and then we see the fraction of women thinning out as we climb up the career ladder. And that's a very generalizable phenomenon, not just for the financial sector, but really across industry, I mean, including in academia, my home where I am. But yes, so there's a number of things we can do in performance appraisals. And I know a number of companies, in fact, are reviewing their performance appraisals. Some completely do away with them because they're not satisfied by what they produce. But here are two things that the companies should really take a close look at. The first one is that many organizations have their employees self-evaluate and assign a rating to themselves before they share these self-evaluations with their managers. It turns out that as soon as you throw numbers at people, not just in performance appraisals, but also in negotiations, for example, that tends to affect how we judge someone. We call this anchoring, so it kind of throws an anchor at our minds. And what we found was that managers then are unable to evaluate that person objectively. And typically, what we do find is that women tend to be less self-confident than men, partly because that's what they want to do, but also because they know that they cannot afford to brag, quite the same way as men can. We call this social backlash. So they will assign themselves on average, lower ratings, and that will affect their managers. So no evidence suggests that sharing self-ratings with managers before they make up their mind has any positive impact. So this is a practice that we should really do away with tomorrow. But let me give you one more example, which might also speak quite directly to your situation, and that is that many organizations evaluate their employees based on past performance as well as future potential. And we typically see the bias creep in on potential, not so much on performance. Again, I don't think it's such a big surprise because performance is more easily measurable, and we're looking backwards. Now, with potential, we look forwards, and it is that place where we cannot imagine that women would want to climb up the career ladder or would have, in fact, the potential to climb up the career ladder.
Radian, thank you very much for your call, and so many interesting examples and stories from Iris Burnett and her new book, What Works? Gender Equality by Design. She's a behavioral economist at Harvard. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So what does city council have to do with what the Mets and the Yankees do in their dugouts? We will find out next, because city council has passed a bill apparently aimed at what the Mets and the Yankees do in their dugouts. Stay with us for details.